You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Welcome. I'm Steve Chiotakis. What a week. Nury Martinez, the embattled LA City Council president who stepped down from that role on Monday, has now resigned her District 6 seat altogether. Now, you've no doubt heard a lot of nasty stuff from that secret tape of LA City Council members and the labor leader that cost at least Martinez her job. It landed like a Scud missile in City Hall over the weekend, and the reverberations continue to this day, including calls for the others to resign, from the mayor on up to the president. Today, we're going to start our show by focusing on this one moment in that conversation.
It serves us to not give her all of K-Town, because if you do, that solidifies her renter's district, and that is not a good thing for any of us. You have to keep her on the fence.
That's former City Council President Nury Martinez saying that it's not good for us, meaning herself, Gil Cedillo, and Kevin De Leon, to solidify the renter's district of council member Nithya Raman. You have to keep her on the fence, Martinez says. You just heard it there. And council member Nithya Raman is with us right now to talk about it. Council member, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
The news today is that California's Attorney General Rob Bonta says he will investigate LA's redistricting process. I want to start with that, saying it's, quote, sorely needed to help restore confidence in the redistricting process for the people of LA. What's your response to that?
You know, for me, as someone whose district was deeply impacted by that redistricting process, I think my district borders were the most changed from it for some of the reasons we heard on those recordings. I think for me, what I think is the most important thing to be doing in this moment is to be reforming the process.
Do you think this is a job for the Attorney General?
For me, a new redistricting process, that feels like a job for the council members to put together. And that's exactly what we were...
I want to make it clear, though. So when I say the Attorney General is involved, are you saying that he shouldn't be involved? That the city council should
do this on its own? No, sorry. No, I just mean that for me, this is the priority. I am looking at opportunities that the council has to restore trust and faith at this moment when we have really shaken the people's faith in those of us who are in City Hall right now. And I don't think this was the only moment where that trust and that faith has been shattered. I'm looking back to the past few years where we've seen multiple council members be indicted by the FBI for corruption and bribery, particularly related to land use issues. Our city government has a lot of opportunities where elected representatives use their office for personal political gain or just for personal gain. It isn't just that there's no independence in the redistricting process. It's also that our land use decision making gives so much discretion to sitting council members. And so council members have a lot to do with what gets built, what doesn't get built, how it looks, the shape of what gets built is often left to individual council members to decide, particularly because our community plans are so incredibly outdated. Everything that's built is an exemption from our existing rules.
What do you think Nury Martinez means when she says on the tape that she wants to keep you on the fence and not solidify your renter's district?
One of the issues that drove my campaign, one of the things that I've worked on since I've been in council, is to make sure that renters' rights are really, really enacted here in the city of Los Angeles. There are, I think, a lot of rules that are in place, but that are hard to implement. I want to make sure that renters know about them, that they have access to real resources like legal counsel and be protected to stay housed and to stay in their homes. Making sure that we protect renters has been part of my agenda during my campaign and during my time in office. And I think what she was saying at that moment was that if I were to get a district which had even more renters in it, that my chances for re-election would be strengthened because my policymaking has tried to ensure that tenants are able to access their rights.
LA has an independent redistricting commission, but its recommendations were thrown out by the council, and the final district lines were quite different, as you know. And look at your district now mm-hmm. that has changed so much just in that time. Mm-hmm. The council vote was unanimous for the revised lines. I mean, did you think the end result was an improvement from what the commission had recommended?
So there were multiple votes to approve the maps for the new lines. And I voted initially against it because I wanted to protest the fact that so much of my district, the district that had elected me, was taken away from me. But ultimately, I knew that the new district lines would be passed by the council. And I love my new district. I have loved meeting my new residents, my new constituents. And one of the reasons I ultimately voted for the map in the final vote was to demonstrate to my new constituents that, you know, I would serve them as well as I had served the district that I had originally been elected from. And I thought that was important for me to do.
There's a charter amendment that's been put forward that's very similar to one that you put forward last year that would take from the council the power over redistricting and leave that power with an independent commission.
I have a motion that would put that charter amendment on the ballot. So charter amendments can go on the ballot in one of two ways. Either citizens can get together and gather signatures to put it on the ballot, or that the council can itself propose those measures to be put on the ballot. And I have proposed exactly this, an independent redistricting commission, a measure for that to be put on the ballot. Whenever that process makes its way through the council, that we place it on the next available election ballot.
You're putting forward also a whole reform package that also calls for expanding the number of city council members. You think that's going to fly?
There's been a flurry of motions that have come in over the last couple of days that are all pushing towards governance reform at the city. There have been motions that have languished in council for a very, very long time that are also looking at these issues. For a long time, these motions either didn't move at all or moved extremely slowly, as my independent redistricting motion moved extremely slowly through no, you know, I don't control that. I think that this moment is a moment where there will be a lot of support for governance reform. That's why yesterday, one of the things I proposed was to actually create a special committee, an ad hoc committee that's focused on all of these reforms in one place, that really tries to think about how do we restore trust in our local city government? How do we make sure that we create rules that limit the opportunities for corruption and for self-interested political manipulation like what we saw? You know, I think that kind of focus is what will move us along in this process. And I think right now, because of the crisis that we're in, I feel like there's more support for that than there has been. And I'm excited to hopefully move it forward.
Nithya Raman, who represents LA City Council District 4. Madam Council Member, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Resign Gail! Resign Gail!
First of all, f*** you, f*** De Leon, f*** Nori, and f*** Cedillo. F*** this whole meeting right here because it's
scientific research has told us that the oldest bones found were that of a black woman. This information is for Nori, Ron, Gil, and Kevin. And anybody else talking in that Jim Crow antebellum South back room.
Those are the sounds of the Los Angeles City Council in a week of news that's highlighted division, power plays, and worst of all, blatant racism. And calls, of course, from all the way to the White House for three members to resign, one of whom already did today. Council President, or at least former Council President, Nuri Martinez. She has resigned her seat altogether. Well, now imagine that's the place where you're about to go to work. That's what Eunices Hernandez is facing when she takes her District 1 seat on the council in the coming weeks. And the council member-elect is with us right now. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were on the front row yesterday. Why was it important for you to be there?
It was important for me to be there for a few reasons. Number one, to stand and support my colleague, Mike Bonin, and his family. You know, there's a lot of pain that they're experiencing, and so I just wanted him to know that we were there to support him. And two, as a Latina woman, to be present and to show that what we've heard in those audio tapes is not reflective of all of our community. And that I'm willing to do the work and to continue to do the work to do healing and to build bridges amongst our communities, particularly the Black and Brown communities.
I'm going to ask you a question that I probably know the answer to, but you heard resign Gil Cedillo. You ran to unseat Gil Cedillo. You won. You are unseating him. Do you think he should step down right now?
Without a doubt. It just blows my mind that he has not stepped down.
What do you make of even the president of the United States getting involved and saying that they should go and all the national attention that this is getting?
If it was me, I would be extremely embarrassed. That is, that it's gone all the way to the president, that it's in international news, and that the calls for resignation are at a national and international level. I hope that they hear the calls and they make the right decision to step down.
Are you worried about how, you know, the national perception of you know, Angelenos and what's happening at the city council, you know, that it's that this is sort of a stain on L.A.?
I don't think it's a stain on Los Angeles. I think it's a stain on the Los Angeles City Council that for many years have left communities behind, that have implemented policies that have disproportionately impacted Black and Brown indigenous communities and communities of color. And so I feel that that's where the stain is, and you can see that in who the community has put into power in these new elections. I was voted in. They've voted not to have Gil Cedillo in, and that's a reflection of the lack of confidence that they have for our government. So the Angelenos, you know, they are reflective of the most beautiful things. We're one of the most diverse cities. We see communities working together.
I certainly don't want to keep focusing on the tape because the tape is so disturbing anyway. But going back to it for just a second, I mean, what does it make you feel like to hear not only the blatant racism on the tape, right, which we all have heard, but also just the reason for the meeting in the first place? Like, these folks were gathered in a power play, and that's sort of how City Hall works. Should that be how City Hall works?
No, you know, the audio tapes, I'm so angry. You know, this conversation wasn't just a power play conversation. It's over a year ago that this happened, and we have now seen that conversation has had real life implications on our lives, both in the redistricting process, in destroying Nithia's district, in appointing someone for CD10. You know, I just can't believe that this has happened. But just to take a step back, the conversation was supposedly to uplift Latino power and community power. But the analysis that they have is so immature. They don't see the long run. They're not talking about the systemic issues around homelessness, around lack of affordable housing, and how it impacts predominantly Black, Brown, Indigenous, and communities of color and low-income communities. So for me, it just shows that they don't have a real analysis of what our community needs and what are the actual appropriate steps to meet those needs.
Are you concerned about this maybe throws more gasoline on tensions between the Black and Brown communities?
Without a doubt. That's why I'm so upset, because on the ground, at the community level, people like myself, people like Assemblymember Isaac Bryan, Kenneth Mejia, Hugo Soto Martinez, have done for years the labor of building bridges between our communities to uplift the communities that are most disproportionately impacted by the systemic failures of our city. And for them to do this erases a lot of that work, and it takes us back decades that now we have to again go and try to build and try to fix the errors of the generations before us. So it's upsetting. I'm at a loss for words.
Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell, who's now the sitting president, at least for now, introduced a motion that would increase the number of council members that LA has. He said there have been 15 seats there since 1925, so for nearly a century. Obviously, a lot more people live here now than in 1925. He also says the council needs more members to represent them effectively. What do you think about that?
I agree. You know, we are a 15-member body that represents over 4 million people. My district alone is over 260,000 people. We need to expand the city council, and I look forward to that analysis to figure out what the number is it that we need to provide equity and services to our communities. I think it's a great idea, and we need to move forward to implement.
What do you hope comes out of this mess? I mean, is there a possibility that something good could come from this? I mean, do you believe that that's even possible?
I do. I do because I've seen it. I've dedicated myself, you know, I'm a Latina woman. I come from the Latino community. I've seen the anti-blackness, the racism in my community. And it's taken me years to move people into a better direction. And so I believe that it's possible, but it requires patience. It requires love. It requires political education. And if folks are willing to do that work, I believe that it'll happen. And I do believe we're in a better place. Because when you think about policies that have been implemented, like 4118, and you look at the homeless population and how it's a large majority compared to the population are people who are Black, it's disproportionate. You know, we are in a place where we can actually push back on these policies that are blatantly racist, that are blatantly impacting our communities of color. And so, like I said, the truth shall set us free. And we're in a place where you can no longer hide these policies that are actually impacting, you know, Black, Brown, Indigenous communities more than any other policies that we have.
We certainly wish you the best of luck going in. I know it's a tumultuous time over at L.A. City Hall. Eunices Hernandez, council member-elect for L.A. City Council District Number 1. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, a fight in the desert over whether Joshua trees should be protected. That's yours on the other side of this. Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's zoom way out of the city of LA now and head out to the desert. At a nature preserve in Joshua Tree, there stand the town's namesake plants. And just hours ago, these iconic beloved trees of the Mojave just earned a few more months of temporary protection. For years, California officials have struggled to decide whether to list these trees as an endangered species. It might sound like a simple decision to make. If a plant or animal looks like it's going extinct, add it to the list. But even when the commission finally makes a decision, the fate of these trees is far from sealed. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has a story about what it takes to save a California tree.
It starts out simple. A member of the public makes a case to the California Fish and Game Commission that a species needs protection. In this case, the Western Joshua tree, the ones that grow in California. Their champion is a guy named Brendan Cummings.
15 or so years ago, I did the litigation that forced the Bush administration to protect the polar bear under the Federal Endangered Species Act.
He's conservation director for the Center of Biological Diversity. He's litigated plenty of Endangered Species Act cases, but this one's personal. He's got dozens of them in his backyard here in the town of Joshua Tree. They're spiky, twisty branches pointed wildly, Dr. Seuss-ily, skyward.
If you look around us here, the adult Joshua trees we're seeing were recruited into the population under a climate that no longer exists.
But the case he's making isn't easy. California has never listed a species because it's threatened by climate change. There are still lots of them, millions, spanning thousands of square miles. When you list a plant as endangered, you have to jump through more hoops to develop the land where it grows. You have to either avoid killing it or move it to a new place or pay a fee for killing it. Kelly Herbinson says it's worth the trouble. She's the co-executive director of the Mojave Desert Land Trust, whose whole mission is to set aside acres of desert habitat for preservation.
What we are seeing right now is unprecedented. This is serious. And I don't know that that's always obvious if you're not doing this every day and working on the land every day and the effects.
The threats they face are different depending on where you're standing. At lower elevations, the Western Joshua tree is facing the effects of the worst drought in more than 1,000 years.
But if you were to go to, say, the West Mojave or even areas nearby where the drought has been really bad, I mean, they're mostly brown. There's little bits of green left, but they really are sort of these zombie forests.
Zombies meaning at a glance they look alive and well, but they're struggling, not reproducing, and the effects might take years to see. In its middle elevations, the Joshua Tree has been separated into small island habitats, checkerboarded by decades of development as the human population in the desert continues to grow.
Joshua trees are similar to everything else, where as soon as you start fragmenting their habitat, they're going to start to suffer because they're not able to have that genetic flow between populations.
And then, of course, at its middle and higher elevations, like where we're standing now, the Joshua tree is facing a threat it rarely encountered before.
We're having significantly increased wildfires across the desert region, across everywhere, right? This isn't a local problem for us.
On this piece of land, a stray cigarette in 2020 burned most of the Joshua trees on a quarter of the 600 acres that the Mojave Desert Land Trust saved from becoming a housing development. And she says that's becoming more common.
That is not something that happened historically, and there's this massive overgrowth of invasive plant species that are blanketing the desert and creating this massive fuel load. And then it dries out because we're in a drought. And then you just have this carpet of dried plants that are ripe to burn.
There's also the problem of the tree's lifelong partner, the yucca moth.
The tree is completely reliant on the moth to survive.
And the moth is completely reliant on the tree. The moth lives underground at the base of its tree for years, waiting for it to flower. And in the spring, when it finally does, it emerges and pollinates the tree in exchange for food and a safe place to produce larvae. Thing is, as the climate changes, scientists have found that the moths aren't reproducing like they used to, and their fate is tied up with the Joshua tree. The Department of Fish and Wildlife spent months studying the trees. Their job is to provide all the data and expertise that the commission needs to make a decision. And then, at the board meeting in June,
widespread and abundant species tend to be less vulnerable to extinction.
The department determined that there just isn't compelling evidence that it's in danger of going extinct in the foreseeable future, that it has time to adapt to climate change. So they recommended the commission vote against listing. But almost all the peer-reviewed scientists said that finding was wrong. And on decision day back in June, hundreds of members of the public showed up to throw in their opinion, too. In one corner, you've got local politicians.
Listing the Joshua tree as an endangered species will have permanent economic damages to the livelihood of my constituents.
The local water board, building developers, the labor unions.
This would take away a lot of the jobs that solar companies provide for us to do out there in the vast desert that's out there.
Saying that listing an abundant tree in the desert as endangered would hurt development and jobs. But then in the other corner with conservationists and local residents, you've got national politicians like Dianne Feinstein, who submitted a statement supporting the scientists. And local tribal groups.
It's so intertwined in our history, our traditions, our stories. Everything includes these Joshua trees, and we owe it to them. They've protected us. They've provided for us.
All making the case that the Western Joshua tree is disappearing and needs to be protected. The commission reached a stalemate in June, and today they decided unanimously to delay the decision again until February to leave room for more tribal consultation. Cummings says he's not surprised by the delay, but even if the commission lists the Joshua tree next year, he doubts the fight will end there either.
Various business interests will undoubtedly sue, trying to overturn that protection. And conversely, if the commission votes against protecting Joshua trees, I will sue, attempting to overturn, you know, that unscientific decision. So the future of the species, you know, is likely to be contested for the next few years.
And Herbinson says even though the road ahead to saving the Western Joshua tree is long, she feels optimistic.
I think we can do it. I really think we can do it. This is affecting all the species out here, and that we're coming up with ways to do it.
Today, thousands of Joshua tree seeds sit in mason jars and fridges in a back room of the headquarters where Herbinson works. She says they'll use them to replant the parcel that the fire destroyed in an attempt to help the Western Joshua tree survive. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
That's going to do it for us today. Busy day. Tomorrow, one of the groups singled out in that racist recording from the city council trio is the Oaxacan community. How folks there are responding to the tape and what they hope can be learned from it. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Tell us how you're doing. Share a story idea. What's going on in your neighborhood? Let us know. And subscribe to the podcast, too, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Or just grab the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Search for KCRW Greater LA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, J.C. Bold, Ray Guarna, Amy Tuck, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thank you for your time and attention. Have a great night.